Should we maybe start with just maybe getting a decent idea on what cloud infrastructure is? What is cloud computing maybe just broadly? Is that a fair point to start for us to just maybe understand the nuances later on?
Sure. Cloud is the cloud computing or cloud services is the remote provision by a third party of some computing service, some connectivity service. So, usually it involves a data center somewhere. A data center is just a big collection of computers. You at the edge don't do or run a lot of the services. You connect to the cloud or the cloud data center, and that's where the services come from. So it's a provision of computing services remotely.
So why are we worried? I mean, so I, like fundament like fundamentally, I feel like this is like a technology, right? I mean, this is like we have every few years or every year there is a new technology that comes up. So this feels like another of those technologies. So why are we paying ex why should we pay extra attention to cloud? What is so special about this that not only individuals, but also nation states should probably pay attention.
It's cloud is sort of the logical outgrowth of the internet, which is that you can connect remotely to data and services. And now it's being offered on a commercial scale. Sometimes they're called hyperscalers. And so it's become the backbone technology for finance, for telecom, for research. So cloud is not always visible, but it's become the backbone technology for a lot of the developments we see. 5G, for example, absolutely requires cloud. 6G will require cloud. So you use cloud and you may not be aware of it. You probably are, not you, but I mean people listening. So if you use Outlook, Outlook is cloud. If you use Gmail, Gmail is cloud. So it's become the backbone infrastructure for digital connectivity.
Understood. So till now what I've understood is this technology is probably everywhere in the sense that people might be using it, but they might not know that they're using it, and it's kind of widespread. So what is the danger in what is the danger you see for maybe foreign actors to maybe interfere, or maybe for even their own like let's say if I'm living in India, I mean I am living in India, but what can my own government do to interfere, like let's say with cloud infrastructure to maybe infringe on my rights, or is there are there could you lay out the dangers in this technology maybe?
One of the things that we've found, and this came up very much in the 5G debate, was that given the scale of connectivity, where you have resources and infrastructure outside your own territory, the issue of trust becomes important. So, do you trust the service provider? The second one is, have you taken the steps necessary to ensure the cybersecurity of the infrastructure so that an external party can, without your permission, gain access to it. But the fundamental question is trust. Do you trust the service provider? Do you trust the government that has jurisdiction over the service provider? So that's very much what we went through with 5G, which is if you rely on an untrustworthy infrastructure, you're creating national security risk. For an individual, of course, it's the privacy rules that govern data in your country. It's the guarantees for civil liberties, human rights that apply in your country. But the larger strategic question is trust in the provider, trust in the provider's host government.
And how do we figure out, like, how do we build that trust? I mean, not build that trust, how do we know that some service provider is trustworthy?
The Czech government had a conference at this point, probably about 3 years ago, on 5G, because this was a big concern with many countries thinking of moving from 4G to 5G. How do you determine trust? And they came up with something called the Prague proposal, which is a list of criteria that you can use. It doesn't name any particular country. It doesn't say, don't buy from the US, don't buy from Brazil. It doesn't. It just says there's certain things you can look at that are information in the public domain that show what a degree of trust would be. Is there rule of law in the country? Do they have strong courts in the country? Do they have a record of human rights abuses? Do they have a record of commercial espionage? So there's a number of external factors you can look at. And the most important of these is really rule of law, because if you can take a case to a court and overturn a government decision, that should make you think it's a more trustworthy provider. So it's, I think you can find it under Prague proposals. It's called NUKIB, N-U-K-I-B, which is the Czech agency that did it. Within cooperation with the European Union and with the United States and with Japan. So it's like, what are the external things that would make you say this is a trustworthy provider?
If I'm not wrong, I think the United States leads, or at least the companies in the United States lead services which provide cloud services. In that context, should other countries should blindly trust companies from the US, or how should they probably think about this?
So you basically have three large groupings that could provide cloud services. The European Union had something called Gaia-X, which was going to be the EU cloud, because they didn't want to have the US have data sovereignty. That's what they call it. This is very Macron-esque. And Gaia-X has been a complete bust, because the Europeans are unable to deal with digital technology in a timely fashion. And, you know, it's arguments among the many members. So you're not going to be able to buy cloud from Europe. The other place would be China. And China has some very strong cloud companies, Huawei and Tencent. But of course, no one trusts the Chinese government, and it is very intrusive when it comes to these companies. And so you can buy from them. They offer a good price. It's an okay service. But you have the larger issue of trust in China. That leaves the United States as the least worst of all the choices. A good example would be Apple. Apple has rejected US government requests. Microsoft, Amazon, they're all very cognizant that they're serving a global market. And if they're seen as a tool of the US government, they know that will cost them in the global government. So those are your choices. Europe doesn't work. China, it's Xi Jinping, or the United States, where you do still have rule of law and courts. And that's why people have to pick. And I'll put it this way, the US is the least worst of the choices that you face.
Do you think it's, I mean, I feel like this seems to me, like, on the face of it, seems like the Apple Android duopoly, or, you know, when you look at social networks, maybe, you know, you only have like Facebook and Instagram. Are we just left with like two countries which probably dominate cloud services? Is there no other alternative that we can think of?
No, and I would definitely include TikTok, which is so growing so rapidly. So when you look at social media, you've got a few big ones: TikTok, Meta, Instagram. Am I leaving anyone out? I don't think so. That's probably it. Yeah, Twitter's on the rapid decline under the new ownership. So I would have said Twitter a couple months ago, but I'm not so sure now. But you have a situation where these countries have the most dynamic tech sectors. And so they offer the technologies and services that people would want to use. And it doesn't have to be a duopoly. And so one of the things everyone's watching is, you know, places like India, Brazil, Turkey, Nigeria, perhaps, Indonesia, they have the potential to enter into this and make it a something more than a duopoly. But right now, it's those two large countries that tend to occupy the space.
How much does the government, I think, and this, and at this point, I think I'm maybe specifically talking about the US government, and maybe the Chinese government, maybe. At this point, how much interference do you think there is from the government to these cloud providers? And also, should there be, do you think, in the sense that these companies, these are private companies, and these should be just left alone to do business? You know, cloud is a business, providing cloud services is a business. And do you think that the government should not interfere with the way these companies are run and managed, and, you know, which country they provide the services and how they provide the services? Do you think that the government, US government and any government should probably just leave these companies as be? Or do you think there is that need to maybe regulate slash interfere with these companies? How are you thinking about that?
So the climate has changed markedly in the last few years, which is before, when the internet was created, there was a fear that if you overregulated it, you would kill it. It would never become self-sustaining. And the Europeans kind of proved the case, because when the internet was introduced, at this point, almost 30 years ago, the Europeans had a strong tech sector and their regulation killed it, right? So that was the environment for a long time. Don't regulate to let the internet become strong. That was successful. But now everyone says it's gone too far. We need to regulate. And I think there's a global consensus that big tech needs to be regulated. There's a couple issues. The first is, if you regulate in the European style, you kill the economy. And you can look at this by going to the World Bank or the IMF and looking at GDP growth rates and compare, say, France and the US, where France and the US, the European Union and the US were roughly the same level of income 15 years ago, and the U.S. has now continued to grow while they've remained flat. So there's a general agreement we need to regulate, but if you do it wrong, you kill economic growth. The two key issues are antitrust or anti-competitiveness and privacy. There are fears that the tech companies have grown too big. You can make a case that they are, some of the acquisitions that they've made increase their scope. And so there's a reasonable fear of anti-competitiveness. But the problem is you don't see that fear in China. So the last thing we want is to destroy our own big companies because the space would be filled by the Chinese, right? And that does not make me comfortable. But antitrust is a problem, and we'll need a clearer understanding of antitrust. We don't have one now. The second one is privacy, and privacy is the great failure of the internet. In the United States, there's very little privacy regulation. And so people reasonably say, what happens to my data when these companies acquire it? The Europeans, again, have done it in a way that stifles innovation. We need to find some middle ground. So I'd say those are the key issues, antitrust and privacy. Not really a clear answer on either yet, but I think some regulation is not only inevitable, but necessary.
At this point, I just want to take a step back, because I'm actually still not seeing the problem, in the sense that, in the sense that on an individual level, what I'm thinking of, the biggest reason for me to probably care about this or care which company is holding my data is mostly for privacy reasons. Like, that I can sympathize. Please point out if I'm maybe not getting this right. So at least intuitively, I feel like if I use an iPhone and if Apple is holding my data, if the cloud provider is not, if their security is not strong, and if they don't take care of my data really well, and if they share it with third party, et cetera, I don't want that, because I may get ads, which I don't want to have. I don't want my personal data to be leaked. So basically, I want my data to be, confidential and private and encrypted and so on and so forth, mostly for privacy reason. But in terms of like why the US government should care, I'm still not very clear as to like why, what is so important about this that that they should care about it. And if they care about it so much, then why don't they start their own? Why don't they start their own maybe cloud service and like whatever data, government data that they have, keep it in their servers? So maybe could you paint a picture? Sure. Could you maybe clarify that, because I'm still not clear actually.
The concern for governments is in some ways similar to the concern for individuals, which is you want to ensure that your data is secure. For an individual, that's through contract. What is the cloud company contracted to do with you to protect your data? But you have a third problem with some service providers, which is what is it their government can ask them to do for access to data or to disrupt services? And what would be the response? So if it's easy to see, and you've seen examples of American companies refusing government requests. In fact, India sometimes make requests to the cloud service providers that are refused or at least not responded to in a timely fashion. No one believes that that would happen in China, and that's the fundamental difference, is the Chinese government has a degree of control that could make it easier to get access to data, could make it easier to disrupt services. And the Chinese companies are not in a position to dispute that. So for an individual, it's what are the privacy rights I have around my data? What is the contract obligations I have for cybersecurity? For a government, it's do I have a good contract? Can I trust the host government? Can I trust the service provider? And it's a very different world depending on who you look at.
Understood. So now...
Let me just add,
sure.
The company that probably does the best on this, strangely enough, is Apple. And I'm not sure why that is. Some say it relates back to Tim Cook's childhood or something, but Apple is very tough on privacy. They don't share data. They don't sell data. The other cloud companies, perhaps not as tough. So if there's one place that does a tough job on privacy, it's Apple.
But in China, I think they still share. I think they still share with their government, no?
And that might be the big problem for Apple, is that they have made concessions to the Chinese government regarding Chinese user data. And their answer is, if we didn't make those concessions, China would not allow us to operate there, right? But they haven't made similar concessions to any other government.
Could it be that, could it be that other governments have not asked for such data?
The U.S. has a very complex system for asking to data because it involves getting a warrant or getting authorization from the Department of Justice. That's true for many countries. The U.K. has a similar system. So, and it's usually reported publicly. Most countries have an annual report. Here's how many times we asked for data. In other cases, the procedure is a little more ad hoc. So I know... India has had trouble, for example, with end-to-end messaging on Facebook and end-to-end encryption. And so does Britain, so does the U.S. But the companies have not been as amenable to doing something for them when it comes to that. So you have different procedures, and it's very much governed by the constitutional rights, the legal framework of the country the cloud provider is operating in.
And I think for Apple, China is such a huge market that I don't think they can just, not give in to such demands. Like, it'd be very difficult to turn away from, I think it's second largest market, or I think the first largest market. Yeah.
And that's exactly right. It's a market thing. And the Chinese would have no compunction of forcing Apple out of the market if Apple didn't comply. Apple employees have told me that if we didn't go along, the Chinese would force us out of the market.
Yeah. I want to go back to the point that you made, which is in terms of government. So there are some governments that we probably cannot trust because they might have the authority to ask or request or force the company or the cloud providers to force them to hand over the data. In that case, why? And let's take the example of China, maybe, because I think China has laws which, if you're a Chinese company, they have to hand over the data that the Communist Party or the CCP request them to do so. So in that case, why don't the countries just not work with these companies? Like, if they know that that they are allowed to that they have, that they have to hand over the data if the government asks them to do so. So why don't they just not work with them and maybe select some alternative companies where there is more strict strict handle on the data?
Well, the for most countries other than China and a few others, Russia and Iran and the countries like that, for most countries, there's a legal process you have to go through to request data, and that, that legal process can be appealed in court. And so if the company felt that it was asked, being asked to do something inappropriate, it could challenge it in court. Certainly Apple has done that in the past. Microsoft has done that in the past. You can go and say and expect a reasonable outcome and say, I'm not going to comply with this request for data. See you in court, right? And you can't do that in China. And I'd say that's the biggest difference is if you can trust the legal system, if it's relatively transparent, if it's relatively unbiased, then you can go ahead and use those cloud service providers.
Could we, like, if we were to analyze China and its goals and its ambitions with this cloud infrastructure, how do you think about that? Maybe even on a, if we could zoom out, like, with its global ambitions as well, like how does this fit in, like the tech part, the cloud part?
Well, it's assumed that the Chinese would like to have the benefits of dominating the global communications infrastructure. And so it began with the Chinese did not trust Western providers. And so they built their own undersea cables, and they built their own communication satellites, and they built their own internet, and they created the Great Firewall. But now the theory is they'd like to expand that because it gives them a greater degree of international influence. And it gives them international influence. It gives them increased market share. It puts them at the cutting edge of technology. For those reasons, China pursues this kind of leadership, right? Because there's clear policy benefits to it. U.S. policy is a little more confused, you know, natural in a democracy, but the theory is that if it's a level playing field, companies can compete fairly. There's concern about China dominating the global communications infrastructure, of which cloud is a backbone element. So I think it's that concern that drives this. If China was not a country of concern because of its foreign policy, you would not see a problem with Chinese cloud companies. But because of China's larger policies, which Xi Jinping has been fairly frank about, he wants to move China to the center of the world stage. He wants to make the world safe for the Chinese Communist Party. Those kinds of things concern people, and that's why they're concerned about China being the service provider for communications, for cloud, for the internet.
And how much progress do you think China has made? Like, in the sense that the way I'm thinking about it is, I think globally, US is still dominating the cloud space. I'm not sure of the overall communications. I think you're also talking about, one is you're talking about the cloud aspect, but also you're talking about the overall communications strategy. So how much progress do you think China has made? And you also mentioned how US has a messy policy at this point, like a confused policy. So do you think that that's going to play a part where China can probably leapfrog in a few years if they have like very strategic focus in these communications technology?
China is very strong in some parts of the world. I would say it's dominant in Africa. It's growing rapidly in Latin America. Southeast Asia, it's a little more balanced. The Middle East, they've grown rapidly. So China's been very successful in some places in building the infrastructure. They are not as successful yet in terms of cloud infrastructure, but it's one of the goals they've set for themselves. And so when you talk to Huawei executives, they say, look, the market in China is shrinking. It's not growing very fast. We're looking to a global market. So China's policy has had some success, I'd say, in those two regions, in Africa, certainly, and increasingly in Latin America.
So how does it do it in the sense, like, how is it so dominant in these continents, and like how does it manage to do it?
So China has one advantage, which is they, until recently, were willing to spend money. And the U.S. Has other goals for its assistance programs. It has limited assistance. So the Chinese, which I, someone I know from the African Union put it to me this way, the Chinese show up and give us money, the Americans show up and give us lectures, right? So I think initially it was the willingness to subsidize, immense subsidies, that gave China an inside position. They're running into some debt problems now. Belt and Road has probably peaked. They have their own domestic debt problems, but Chinese also are willing to provide training. The Chinese are willing to provide education. So Chinese have a very attractive package, but the core of it is money.
But you mentioned until recently. Is there of that slowing down, the flow of money slowing down to these countries?
Yeah, China has debt problems. They have complaints that Belt and Road hasn't been as productive. Many countries are now wary about taking Belt and Road money. Sri Lanka is a good example of a country that made some agreements that it now perhaps regrets. So I think between some hesitation on the part of recipients and some financial issues within China, Belt and Road is slowing down.
In what other ways does China worry you?
Well, the main thing is that the Chinese, they don't accept the norms and rules that apply to other countries when you look at how they engage in business. So they have predatory trade practices. They have a very expansive definition of sovereignty. And so Vietnam, Malaysia, Taiwan, the Philippines, Japan have all had problems with the Chinese saying, oh, by the way, in the 15th century, the Mongol Empire had this as part of its territory, and that's really us, so we own it. The Russians are going to have this problem too. It is a bit funny because the peak of the geographic spread of what we now call China was under the Manchus, who are not Han Chinese, but the Han sort of skip over that. So I think it's the definition of sovereignty. The preference for Marxism is just a bad idea because of its effect on human rights. It has a long-term effect on economic growth, but human rights in China are not very good, right? So in most countries, in many countries, you can go and object to the government. There's an old joke here that an American and a Russian are talking, and the Russian says, tell me why you think human rights are better in the U.S. And the American says, I can go stand in front of the White House and say, down with Joe Biden. And the Russian says, well, I have the same right. I can go stand in front of the Kremlin and shout down with Joe Biden and nothing will happen to me. That's a good example, is where do your political opponents end up? Be interesting to know what's up with China's foreign minister. I assume it's health, but to have the foreign minister disappear for 3 weeks and no word on his, that's just odd. So it's an odd country. And I'd say that a lot of that has to do with the Leninist nature of the party and with China's historic ambitions.
I think the Alibaba founder also, I think, had disappeared for a few months, if weeks, if not months, if I'm not wrong,
3 months,
during the crackdown. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good example. An executive gets on your nerves. He's now teaching in Tokyo, but he lived in his basement for 3 months because the Chinese government was unhappy with him.
So you have painted. So there are obviously problems with the way China maybe does business and China governs as well. And on the other side, you have the US, which is also like a technology leader. And then we have the US-China relationship. How does that fit in to the problems that you just mentioned?
Well, the US, so all Western countries seem to be going through a populist moment where you have objections to the status quo and to the ruling elite. And so it's not just the US, but you've seen it. You had Boris Johnson in the UK. You have Alternative for Germany in Alternative for Deutschland in Germany. You had the Yellow Vests in France. You have a populist discontent with the status quo, and the symbol, you had Berlusconi. The symbol for that, of course, is Donald Trump. So the U.S. is having political turmoil. I don't worry about it so much. We had political turmoil like this in the 1970s. In fact, worse in the 70s. But it creates this impression that, so you have all these fears. Russian influence operations will upset the election. They probably won't, but there's a sense of vulnerability on the American side. The one place that I think we need to be careful about is technology has been a source of growth for the U.S., a significant source of growth. If we take a European model of regulation, we could strangle that growth. The Chinese will not. They have their own problems. I mean, no one in their right mind would be a Marxist, right? It's the great policy failure of the 20th century. But in the U.S., we're going through a period of doubt and confusion.
So what, but where do you think U.S. is going wrong? Like, in what ways, is it making mistakes?
Well, there's two categories. The first is the class differences here have become much more stark in the last 20 years, as stark as they've been in more than a century, where you have concerns among the lower middle class, the working class, that their children will not have the same opportunities that they had. And they're probably right. We have a dilemma where, let's take healthcare. The U.S. is number one in spending on healthcare. We're number 23 in infant mortality. We're number 13 overall in health and life expectancy. So you have this problem where the U.S. spends huge sums of money and doesn't get good outcomes. And that's a problem that we will need to confront. Our tax policy is broken down. So you have billionaires who pay 10%, while your normal citizen pays 25%. That's some of the root of the populist moment, is this unhappiness with how things are going in society. The other risk, it's smaller, but it's still there, is that reasonable concerns about the effect of technology, reasonable desire to regulate technology, but if we get that regulation wrong, we'll end up killing growth the way the Europeans killed growth. So I think those are the two fears, is how do we regulate the digital environment in a way that preserves growth? How do we make it a more equitable society when it comes to the benefits of healthcare and education?
So you seem to be suggesting that, for me, those suggestions seem like recommendations for the U.S. to get its house in order. Like, there seems to be some issues internally with the U.S. and it needs to clean up its mess. But does that also mean that you're not, is it that you're not optimistic about the U.S.-China relationship improving in the coming years? Or even if it improves, you think it's not going to make much of a difference and, things are just going to continue the way they were?
One nice thing about democracies is they eventually work through their problems. So we'll work through this as we've worked through it in the past. It'll be bumpy. And one thing that's changed is you have a much more Gesundheit. You have a much more vibrant discourse that tends to be a bit shallow. So people tend to panic. They get shiny object syndrome. It's like, so AI is everyone's shiny object. Oh, AI, the risk of AI. How do you know there's risk? Well, we don't. But I think we'll work through our problems. With China, we're not yet at the point where a deal is possible. What are the concessions the U.S. would make to China? And what are the concessions the Chinese would make back? One thing, people say, oh, we've gone too far. We've pushed too hard on China. We should cut them some slack. I have not seen any indication from Beijing that they're interested in making a concession. So you can't have a negotiation unless both sides want to talk. right? And the Chinese aren't there yet.
In do you think that the talks that have been happening with regards to TikTok, that'll be like, that'll probably set like an example on how business is done with Chinese companies globally, or at least in the US? How are you looking at the TikTok? Do you think that's a relevant, you know, it's a relevant battle in this war?
It's interesting because it's this issue of trust again, which is, do people trust TikTok? TikTok and its owner, ByteDance, is located in Beijing. It's not a question of, do you trust ByteDance or not? It's a question of, ByteDance is subject to Chinese law. Chinese law says that no company can deny any request from the intelligence services. That creates distrust. So we'll see where TikTok comes out, but it's moving very slowly. I think it's a problem for all countries, which is that you have this issue of the Chinese government can make requests for information from its intelligence services, and you don't have the grounds for to object. You know, that creates reasonable distrust. So I don't think TikTok hasn't played out. Let's see how it continues. It could end up being restricted. It could end up being denied access, at least to U.S. financial services. This TikTok story isn't over.
In terms of spending money on assistance or just to build out infrastructure per se, I think we spoke about how China was doing that in like Latin America and like Africa. Do you think the US also should probably start, you know, spending money on these things? Do you think that would help?
The good news for these countries is that in the Cold War, the US and Russia competed by offering aid packages. Right? And sometimes the Russian aid package wasn't always perfect. I know one time they sent snowplows to an African country. Not ideal, but there was this sense that aid, foreign aid, was a tool of foreign policy. And in the US, that ended in the 1990s with the end of the Cold War. And now aid is seen as a tool of social policy. And we need to get back to thinking of it as a tool of foreign policy. We're not there. And that will require a shift in US thinking. We're on the path to seeing, but we have not yet reached the end of that path.
If I'm not wrong, I think China also, I think the Chinese government, do you think they subsidize the R&D or, you know, if the cloud companies or these communications companies are in turmoil, I think there is some subsidy from the government itself or some financial support from the government. Could you maybe comment on if that is true or not? And also, does that play a role in maybe them dominating this field in the long run, or some effects that it might have in the short run as well?
So most governments subsidize R&D in some way, but a lot of them subsidize basic research, you know, scientific research. China also has in the past provided illicit subsidies to its companies to make them more competitive. So a European company will go and say this will cost $10. A Chinese company will go and say this will cost $7 because they're getting the support from the government. So it's the illicit subsidies that create a problem, not support for R&D. All countries do that. The other part is one way that China supports R&D is by stealing other people's technology through espionage. And I think that's the two areas of concern, espionage and illicit subsidies. But if they want to subsidize R&D, it's their perfect right to do so. It's not their right to do subsidies or illicit subsidies or espionage.
How are you thinking about maybe data localization in the sense that in India, let's say if Facebook, Facebook has its operations in India, and whatever data it collects of Indian citizens, it should probably build data centers here and, do business in that way. Do you think that might be a solution or which might alleviate some of the problems?
Well, it's, I'm going to let this fire engine go by. Sorry. There, okay. So, you know, data localization undercuts the economic benefits of cloud services, which is that you have resources. The classic example is the resources are in use in the Western Hemisphere from 9 to 5, and they're not in use in the Eastern Hemisphere because of the time zone differences. And then the ability to pass loads back and forth to balance loads because of the different workloads, because of just the diurnal schedule, you lose that, right? You lose some of the security benefits with data localization. But countries feel strongly about it. If you had clearer rules on data protection, I think that would help reduce the impetus for data localization. One of the problems is that sometimes people assume that data has immense value, and so therefore data is the new oil. When I hear that, I always think data is the new snake oil, because it's not, it's in itself, it's not useful. But a country like India can make these demands. There's some benefits to law enforcement that people worry about. If the data is located in your country, it's much easier to get access under a warrant than if it's not. And so part of what we've got is, since we don't have a global agreement on privacy, since we don't have a global agreement on law enforcement access to data, and since we don't have a global agreement on cybersecurity, data localization can be attractive, even though it's inefficient.
What policy, are there any policy recommendations that you might have that you think the US, if it implements, would be much better off for the US?
We need to start thinking about a broader approach to digital governance and agreement internationally on digital governance. There's been some work in ASEAN, in Europe, in a few other places, but the fact that you don't have this digital governance framework that increases the friction in the system. So a good model to compare it to would be the financial system. Very broad agreements, far-ranging agreements, institutions that make the transfer of money between countries easier than it would be otherwise. And that has true economic benefit. We need to do something similar for data, and we have not done that yet.
Do you think there is political will to do these things? Or even if not the specific recommendations, maybe at least the will to think about these problems and maybe act on them?
People are groping for a solution, and people are moving in this direction, perhaps a little more slowly than we might have hoped. But you've got the effort in the UN with the Secretary General's digital initiative. You've got regional efforts in Southeast Asia and in Europe and other places. People are moving. There's a sense that greater cooperation on digital governance is needed, but we have not yet figured out how to do that and how to make it work.
Any lessons from the Huawei scenario, I think, that happened in the US? Any lessons from that, maybe, that we can take from that situation? Is there anything that...
The biggest lesson is the importance of trust, and you can apply that to cloud and to the whole communications infrastructure. It has to be a trustworthy supplier, right? And that, I think, is the lesson of Huawei, is trust has to be at the centerpiece of digital governance.
So we spoke about US and we spoke about China, but what about US and its allies? Like, what role do you think the allies would have to play? I'm referring to maybe the European countries, or maybe the EU. What role do you see them playing in this, as support of the US, or maybe as opposition to China, maybe?
In an ideal world, there would be much closer cooperation transatlantically. And we should throw in the Quad, which is the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India. So there's vehicles for cooperation. In Europe, it's a little complicated because you have the French trying to use Brussels as a way to reduce American economic influence and to build French influence. But in an ideal world, you would see cooperation in the transatlantic relationship, in the Quad, that would make it easier to address some of these governance problems.
How do you see this playing out? I mean, in the next 3 to 5 years, like, do you have any scenarios, plausible scenarios in your head?
I think that the issue is how do you create mechanisms? How do you create negotiations to address digital governance? And I think we will do that eventually. The question is timeline. How long will it take? And right now it's taking longer than I'd hoped, but I think people have recognized the importance of it and will push to find some vehicle. It may not be the UN initially. It might be a regional, or it might be like-minded countries. But I would say within 5 years, we'll have that's a little optimistic. There's a chance that within 5 years, we would have a framework for digital governments that is a global framework.
Anything that I forgot to bring up that you would like to maybe...
Trust applies to all countries, the requirement for trust. And so the U.S. has had to rebuild trust. The Europeans have had to build trust. I think, the world is not the world that it was when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was agreed to. I used to, when I worked at the U.N., I used to kid people that if we put the declaration up for a vote now, it would lose, right? And so I think the biggest change here is how do we continue the momentum to move towards greater respect for human rights? How do we deal with the role of the private sector? It's also not the world of tight borders and national companies. You have international companies, not just American. There's Indian, Japanese, European, Chinese companies that are global. And the structure we have of laws and rules struggles a little bit with how to deal with the private sector now. So those are two things I hope we can address. How do we continue to ensure human rights are respected? How do we deal with a global private sector that is as in some ways as influential as governments?
But in the sense that, like, are you happy with the change that, I'll give you one example, maybe India's example, where I think India demands that, I think we earlier spoke about the data center that they have to probably host it in India, but also to get access by the local police, of messages not being end-to-end encrypted, are you happy with that development in the sense that where these local governments, we spoke about India, but any local government, which will have like access to data of that particular resident. In that way, are you like happy with that per se?
Well, the companies have told me that it's a business decision for them, that it costs, a few $100,000 to build a data center. And if the market justifies it, they'll build the data center. The issue is, what are the rules around transferring data across borders? So building a data center so the local government can get access to it when it wants, that's perfectly fine. What isn't fine if they say you can't transfer the data outside the country to do normal load balancing? You can't do that without our permission, because we all know that getting government's permission can take days, if not weeks. So if you do it right, a data center is fine. I think that India is a big enough market that people will look to accommodate it, but it's in India's economic interest not to get in the way of a global system.
Thank you so much for your time. It was wonderful having you.
Thank you. Thanks for that.